Hi guys, it's a real pleasure to be up here. I wanna start with a story. A couple of years ago, I was at a festival, and a lady called Heidi Baker was on stage. I don't know if anyone's heard of Heidi Baker, but she runs this ministry in Mozambique that helps orphans, like thousands of orphans. And she's there, so she's on stage, and there's been a pause in the worship, and she's telling us about a dream she once had. And in this dream, she's walking through a building, and she feels like God leads her to a certain door, and she goes in this door, and inside it's basically this amazing larder. So it's just full of food. It's just full of like chicken and fish and corn and wheat and whatever they eat in Mozambique. But basically, she feels that God says to her, like, I'm going to give you amazing provision of food. Like, you're surrounded by people that are starving and are short of food, but I am going to provide through your ministry. And then she tells us this story, like countless stories, but one of the stories is of this party that she throws with her team, and they invite kind of the poor and the crippled and the blind and like all these people. She's saying like the outcasts in that society, they invite them. And the chefs who are cooking for this amazing party are like, hold on, you've invited way too many people. We've got too many people and not enough chicken. What are we going to do? And it's this modern day kind of story of feeding the 5,000. And she like is just filled with so much faith. And she prays over the chicken. And they keep serving the chicken. And they keep serving it. And it doesn't run out. And the chefs kind of take it home in paper bags. But she just says that God has provided food again and again. She goes back to her dream, and she's like, that was one door, and I went down the corridor, and I saw another door, and I went in this one, and there's no food in it, but there's still the same shelves, but on these shelves, there's body parts. So it's a strange room. But she felt God say, look, through your ministry, you're going to see miraculous healings. There's like a whole shelf of legs for the people that can't walk. There's like boxes of eyeballs for restoring sight to the blind and ears for restoring hearing to the deaf. So she paints this amazing picture, and then she goes on to say how they've seen like hundreds and hundreds, thousands of healings. She says they've seen 100 people raised from the dead. And part of me was like, this is a bit mad. This is like outside of my frame of reference. I'm not, to be honest, sure I completely believe what she's saying. But part of me was like, I really want that adventure. That sounds like what walking with Jesus should be like. It's like she's had this dream from God, and she's chasing it, and she's actually living it out. And you can just see that in the way she's operating on this day. She really knows her identity. So I feel like for me, there's often a disconnect between a calling and walking. So between receiving a calling from God and then actually walking it out. You know, that's tricky sometimes. There's been a number of times in my life when I felt God calling me, kind of prodding me, this is what I want you to do. But often I don't quite feel like I'm on that adventure, you know, walking with him into that. So I want to start, I just want to ask you, what have you felt God leading you into? Maybe it's now or maybe in the past. And what would your walk with God look like if you trusted in those plans he has for you? If you pursued them wholeheartedly? So how do we walk side by side with Jesus into what he's called us to do? Let's go back to Heidi, because she's now kind of face down. She's by the drum kit at the back of the stage. You can't even really see her. She's in the corner. She's on her knees. She's like flailing arms, and like the whole crowd had sat down like a long time ago, but we're kind of 40 minutes into watch her story. And she's carrying on with this dream, because apparently two doors weren't enough. She says, my father's house has many rooms. There's a third door. She's been offered a third door. And the thing about this last door is it's really small. So she has to like stoop down to actually get through it. But when she gets through this small door, inside is Jesus. And she says that like in this dream she's having, like Jesus embraces her. And like there's this real sense of like incredible intimacy. She hangs out in this room with Jesus for hours. And she's like, I don't want to go. I don't want to leave you. I've never felt this intimacy with Jesus before. And he says, you've got to go. You've got to like dish out the body parts. You've got to go dish out the limbs and the eyeballs. I've got something for you to do. But the thing is, I'm going to walk with you. I'm going to walk with you step by step. So there's this picture of like amazing intimacy, but it precedes the adventure. Like she's in this small door, in this small room with Jesus, and then she goes on the adventure. So, yeah, and I believe like that small door, and I'm sure that's what she was trying to explain, that this small door is a metaphor for humility. I want to propose that the key to walking with Jesus is humility. C.S. Lewis says, we maybe all know this quote, but he says, it's not about thinking less of ourselves, humility, not thinking less of ourselves, but thinking of ourselves less. Because when we focus on God and when we've got a right view of God, it shapes a right view of ourselves. I think that's kind of the key to humility. So I want to look at the story of the prodigal son. It's a story about inheritance. I think there's two ways of talking about inheritance. We can talk about the one that's in the future, in like the new creation, the inheritance God's won for us. And then there's also the inheritance in the here and now that we step into as we're kind of adopted as sons and daughters of God. And I believe that our inheritance in the here and now is walking with God in intimacy into what he's called us to do. That's what he's won for us. So the prodigal son's got these two brothers, and they've got a warped view of who their father was. And as a result, they've got a warped view of who they were, like what it meant for them to be his sons. There's two lies in the story. There's two lies that stop them living in the fullness of their inheritance. And if we apply them to us, they're two lies that kind of similarly, they stop us walking into everything he's got for us. And I think the two lies is, the first is that God is not enough. He's not good enough. And the second that kind of leads on to that is that I'm not accepted, that God doesn't accept me. So let's turn to it. If you've got the Bibles, your apps, whatever it is, it's in Luke chapter 15. And it kicks off, or we'll start with verse 11. So verse 11, it says, "There was a man who had two sons. And the younger of them said to his father, 'Father, give me the share of property that is coming to me.' And he divided his property between them. And not many days later, the younger son, he gathered all he had, and he took a journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in reckless living." Crumbs. Like, I don't know what we think of when we think of reckless living. Maybe it's kind of like sex, drugs, rock and roll. But I think our reaction maybe is like, oh, that's not me, you know, like I hit the gym actually, I'm pretty healthy, I'm actually a vegetarian at the weekend, I've like got track of my behaviour, I'm even in a pattern group, like I'm on top of this stuff. But let's not be too quick to dismiss the application, because I think like in that culture, the inheritance formed a significant amount of your identity, because you would take on your father's business. You know, you're your father's son because you did your father's business. And Jesus says this too, right? He says, "For whatever the Father does, that the Son does likewise. For the Father loves the Son, and he shows him all that he himself is doing." So Jesus knew his identity as a beloved son. That shaped who he was and what he did. And like with KXC, you might have heard we talk about how God's being shapes God's doing, what he does, what he's done for us, and that shapes who we are. And our being shapes what we go and do. So that's why I want to talk about this first lie, this God is not enough lie. It's so powerful, because if we forget who God is, then like we forget that he's a God that wants intimacy. He wants to heal us, to lead us, to bless us. Then we forget who we are, like our being. We forget that we're beloved, that we're his children. And then I think the reaction is that we find belonging and we find security and purpose elsewhere and not in God. And we miss out on the inheritance that he has for us, of journeying with him, of going about our father's business. So I want to ask, like, where do you believe God isn't enough, that he won't pull through? Where do you forget intimacy with God and pursue belonging elsewhere? So yeah, as John said, I lead the CAP Center, so Christians Against Poverty, at KXC. And I guess I'd just share that, like, actually when I was thinking about stepping into that, like the biggest wrestle, the biggest hurdle was actually like, do I want to make the sacrifice of like pursuing the career? Effectively, I've gone kind of part-time, so I'm in a way hanging up the career progression a little bit. A bit of a salary cut and a bit of like, the security of like that engineering career is gone a bit. That was like the biggest hurdle in me. It was like, would God pull through? I felt God say, seek first my kingdom. You know, I'll add these things. I'll add the things that you need. So when this is like the invitation that God has for us, right? That we're on a journey with him and he's calling each of us into something different. But what is the response when we believe this lie? You know, the lie that God won't pull through. I think it's like, yeah, I know you want me to switch career, but, you know, I need a couple of more years, sort out my CV, earn a bit for a deposit for a flat, because, like, London's massively expensive, and, like, I could really do with a mortgage and a flat first. Or maybe it's like, yeah, I know, I really feel that you want me to pray for that person, that they'd be healed. But to be honest, I think like the odds of you actually healing them when I pray are like pretty slim. And there's this doubt that like God isn't going to back us. He's not going to pull through. So when we go after security and belonging anywhere other than him, we waste our inheritance. God says, if you want to follow me, be in relationship, step into your inheritance. You need to trust me. Trust that I'm enough. And I'm calling you into what's best for you. So it's about humbling ourselves and stepping through that small door in that sense. And the other way, this is like basically looking at the other way that this lie manifests itself. So for those who don't know in the story, the like poor chap who's like gone off in pursuit of like fun and fame ends up working in a pig pen. He realizes that like that's not the best way to spend his summer. He comes home and he has a big party, and we'll get there in a minute. But what I want to do is just skip to the end of the story, to the older brother. So it's verse 25, and they're having this party, and this is what the happens with the older son. His older son was in the field, and as he came home and drew near to the house, he heard music and dancing. And he called one of the servants and asked what these things meant. And he said to him, your brother has come and your father has killed the fattened calf because he's received him back safe and sound. But he was angry and he refused to go in. His father came out and entreated him. But he answered his father, look, these many years I've served you. I've never disobeyed your command, yet you never gave me even a young goat that I might celebrate with my friends. When this son of yours came, who's devoured your property with prostitutes, you killed the fattened calf for him. You just sense his frustration. So where the younger son, he misses intimacy with his father by finding belonging elsewhere. The older son misses it because he doesn't know that he belongs in the first place. Like he has that truth hasn't sunk in. He's still trying to earn the approval of his father, even though he already has it. And maybe we read that and we're like, yeah, yeah, that's fine. Well, I know I'm saved by grace, you know, like I'm not working to earn like God's love for me. I'm not out there in the field striving. But I think, again, let's not dismiss where this might apply to us. Because I think he believes what he's done in the field is what cultivates intimacy with his father. He says, I've served you all these years. You never even gave me a goat. You know, we never had the party. And he's like, feels like he's missed this relationship. But remember that like God's being shapes God's doing, shapes our being, and it shapes our doing. What we do, the last one, is the consequence of who God is. It's not the other way around. So if our inheritance is walking with God into what he's called us to do, we limit it when we make it about us, when we start with what we're doing. And so I guess this is the question for us. Do we limit what we think God can do? Do we limit to our understanding of him? You know, how much we get our head around him? To the amount that he answers our prayers? Or to how close that, like, we feel his presence to us? Is that how we measure how big God is? There's a guy called Pete Enns. He says, "What we can keep the Creator captive to what we're able to comprehend." That's the danger. We keep the Creator captive to what we're able to comprehend. And I can really relate this because I think for me, this lie of God's not as good as he says he is has just manifested in like intellectualizing God. Because I have definitely spent in the past too much time just thinking about God in my head that I didn't engage with him in my heart. And I miss what he actually wanted to do through me. I felt God say, like, I am the objective truth. It's bigger than your subjective understanding. Like, I'm bigger than that. And I say, like, with the other way I relate to it is more recently with CAP, I've caught myself kind of feeling a bit exhausted, if I'm honest, and just driving on and pursuing a vision that I haven't actually asked God about in the first place. I felt God saying kind of like, get off of your pedestal, because walking on your own strength is a form of pride. And like, I've got you, lean on me. Why would I call you into this if I haven't got your back in the first place? Just trust me. So what is our response to this invitation when we believe the lie that God is only as big as we let him be? I think it's like, yeah, I mean, that sounds great, going out on the streets and like doing that stuff, but like, I've just got to like kind of, you know, bottom out an evangelism plan, you know, how I'm going to like 10 steps to Jesus, how if someone actually talks to me, how I'll do it, and I just want to like get that all in my head and get ready and like do my stuff. Or maybe it's like, actually, I've just got hold of, you know, Rob Bell's new book. I've got a whole new bunch of questions that I need to like get my head around and like sit, work out where I sit on all these different issues, and then I'll do it. Then I'll be ready. But I think when we limit God to what we understand or we experience of him, we limit our inheritance. Because he doesn't need us to defend him. He wants us to trust him and like trust that he is enough in himself. You know what, like the dad says to the older son at the end, he says, son, you're always with me. All that I am is yours. Just trust me, like I want that intimacy with you. Like you need to come through the small door in humility. So if the first lie is that God isn't good enough, I want to talk about the second lie that robs us of intimacy. And I think that is, If we believe God isn't as good as he says he is, then we don't believe that we're as good as he says we are. See, I have these moments when I feel God calling me into something and I kind of glimpse it. Do you ever get that where you like glimpse the future of what it would really look like if you went after what God wanted to do for you? But often my reaction, if I like think back to it, is I get overwhelmed with the sense that God surely doesn't actually want to use me. And it's like an anxiety about what people will think if I put my head above the parapet. It's like a comparison that surely there's somebody else in this talented room of people, you know, that would be better qualified. And I end up discounting myself from what I guess God has for me. So I think we need to acknowledge the reality that the enemy would take hold of anything he can do to stop us actually walking into our calling. Because it says that Jesus came to lead us into fullness of life, but the thief comes to steal and kill and destroy. There's this flip side. I think like when we go back to Genesis, we see that we're beautifully and wonderfully made. Like God breathed life into us. He designed us for relationship with him. And I think like each of us is made for greatness. That's God's wish. But like God says to Cain, like four chapters in, sin is crouching at your door. There's this like mixture of destiny and like brilliance in us. But there's also this fallibility and this weakness. And I think that like speaks into the wrestle we have between like getting a calling from God and actually going for it. There's this innate wrestle inside of us. There's a guy called Will Vanderhart, and he talks about shame. And he says, where guilt is an I did statement, you know, I did this wrong. And it's like a take it or leave it. Shame is an I am statement. It's where the lie that we're unaccepted becomes our identity. So it's so powerful because it conducts all of our emotions, you know, it affects our relationships, it affects our ambitions, that sense that I am not enough, I'm not accepted. So if we believe the lie that we are not chosen, not accepted, what is our response? I think it's something like, no, it's cool. You know, you go ahead. I'm just gonna hang here, you know, do my thing. That's great for you. But what, prayer on the streets? No, I'm fine. You know, that's not really my bag. I'm not cracked up for that. And I think that's fine. Like we all have our gifts, but I think for me, when I give a reason of kind of laziness or busyness or like I'm disengaged in something, I think what's underlying it often is fear, and it's fear that I'm not good enough to go and do it. I think the enemy wants to leave us in this muddle, you know, in our self-doubt. Remember that our being shapes our doing. so he can repeat the lie that we're not accepted, that we're not called by to greatness, until it becomes our identity. He'll condemn us to stop us pursuing everything that God's got for us. He'll leave us in that muddle. Because if we stop going after our calling, we become ineffective for God's kingdom. Like, that's his aim. But this is where the good news comes. Like, the good news is that the truth of the gospel is that, yeah, we're not good enough, but God is good enough. And because of that, we are accepted. We can be accepted. God showed his love for us in this, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. That's the I am. You know, I am a sinner, but God accepts me. He died for me. God never condemns us, but he'll convict us of our sin to reestablish our identity. You know, he draws us out of that place of shame. And he says, that's not you. I've made you for greatness. Come out of that. Come on this journey with me. I've made you for relationship with me. I want to tell you about a CAP client story. So there's a lady who's experienced like great pain in her life, but actually like carries so much wisdom. It's a real joy chatting to her. She talked about the labels she felt society put on her. So she says, I'm a black woman, I'm a single mum, I'm a migrant. And she talked about the implications of unworthiness that she felt that those labels brought. She said, I ended up judging myself by other people's standards until they became my identity. And this created a downward spiral of like crippling anxiety and self-neglect. And she says, I was overwhelmed with severe mental health problems. I couldn't get out of bed for days. I became dependent on benefits, and my flat, filled with clutter, you know, just stuff that she didn't want. And she's suffering with problem debt. She paints this picture of the effect of shame, of believing the lie that she's not accepted, that she's something that actually she isn't. And I also like, what is it that got you out of there? Because she's actually feeling like a whole lot better. And she said she like received incredible love and faithfulness from a volunteer in her life. This is like a few years ago. And that love confirmed God's unconditional love. Like, how much more than this person does God love me? Christ proved I was precious enough, she said. He bought me with his blood. And like in crisis, she said, like nothing would cheer me up except this like inner understanding of God's mercy and grace. She had this conviction, like God's never brought me this far to leave me. He's unchanging. He's never going to leave me or forsake me. So I think we can see how that experience of what God has done has shaped like who she was, and then it's shaping what she could do in him. Because she's not fearful now. She says, I've tasted this love, and I want to go forward, and I want to taste more. So she's an amazing lady with this picture of walking with Jesus. I guess there's a question I've been wondering about. Why does Jesus say this? Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Because when we're aware, I think this is it, when we're aware of our spiritual poverty, we're aware of our need for God. Like, we're aware of that gap between us and God. And when we're aware of our need for God, we come to him in humility. That's what the younger son does, right? He comes home from the pig pen, his like mess in the pig pen, and he says, Father, I've sinned against heaven, and I've sinned before you. I'm not worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants. So he like lessens himself. He's like, I've got a fresh understanding of who I am relative to you. But what's the father's response? You know, he runs and he meets him before anyone else can cast shame on him. He restores his identity. You know, he gives him a robe, he gives him his sandals, and he like reinstates his inheritance. He gives him the ring, like the family ring, that means like that he is accepted, that he hasn't wasted his inheritance. Like that humility leads him back to intimacy with his father. So it's in humility, I think, that the shame of our inadequacy is transformed into belonging. Belonging is like the antidote to shame. It's the opposite. And when we come to God in humility, we find that belonging again in him. So I want to land with this. It's maybe tricky to actually work all this out practically. You know, it's slightly abstract. And there's this thing of like, we're meant to be coming to God in humility, but we also believe that he made us for greatness. Like, that's a funny equation, but I think like we go back to C.S. Lewis's quote. It's not thinking less of ourselves, but it's thinking of ourselves less. Irenaeus said, the glory of God is a living man, and the life of man consists in beholding God. So I think if we want to be walking with Jesus into fullness of life, we start there. We start by beholding God. So there's this narrative throughout the Bible of people first focusing on God and then understanding who they are in him, their being, and then stepping into their inheritance, their doing. Like, take for example Moses. We just heard about Moses. He's like so focused on himself when God calls him. Who am I? Like, I don't have a voice. But God said to him, no, just look up. Look up to me. Your identity is in me, in my being. I am. And Moses focuses on God. He like lifts his eyes. He trusts in him. And he like steps into his calling. He goes to do amazing things. There's this bit where Isaiah, he has this amazing vision of God, like in the heavens. God surrounded by the angels. And in this vision, he's like, has this understanding of who he is. He's like, woe am I. I am a man of unclean lips. And this angel, the angel like comes to him with this hot coal. It's a vision. It's like a metaphor. And the hot coal is touched on his lips. And he says, like, I have made you clean. And so in that moment, Isaiah has this right view of God. He's like, woe am I. And as a result, he has this right view of himself. And like in that moment, he starts this adventure because God says, like, who am I going to send? And Isaiah says, here I am, send me. Like, that's the beginning of his journey, that moment of, like, perspective. Joshua, he understands the holiness of God. He acts in obedience. He, like, consecrates himself. He shows God, like, this is what you mean to me. And God's response is, I will exalt you among the Israelites. I'm going to exalt you. I'm going to lift you up because you get this. You're humble. And he goes on to be this amazing leader. And Jesus, who like walks alongside us on this journey, he takes the form of a servant. He humbles himself. He's obedient to death, even death on a cross. And God highly exalts him. He lifts him up. I think like we find new life in God when we lay ourselves down. We're made whole in him when we come in humility through the small door. Alan Scott's got this great quote. He says, he doesn't want more of him, doesn't want more of him and less of you. He wants all of him in all of you. And it's that moment, I think, the adventure, this like walking with God, this journey begins when all of his being shapes all of our being. And Paul says our spiritual worship is in presenting our bodies as living sacrifices to God. Which sounds like really big. It sounds like, you know, quitting our jobs and moving to the third world and like, whatever you do, I'll go. But I think for a lot of us, what it actually means is like little steps. And it's saying like, God, what are you doing in my context? What are you doing in front of me right now? And like, how can I serve that? How can I be a part of that? That's what it means, I think, to be humble. To be like, God, what are you doing? How can I help? So I've kind of been on this journey a bit of trying to grow in humility, of like learning to adopt that posture of a servant. So it looks like not finding security and belonging in the world, but trusting that the best thing for me to do is to journey with God. It looks like not limiting what he can do through me, but to what I can get my head around. It's not limiting God to how big my understanding is, that stuff. But it's trusting that he is actually far bigger than what I can see him doing. I've got a limited perspective. And it's not believing the lie that, you know, I'm not chosen, I'm not accepted. But actually it's trusting that he wants to use me in this bigger plan. He's got this massive thing going on. He wants me to slot into it. And it's just seeking him in that. It's saying like, here's my heart, here's my mind. Here's my words, my resource, my influence. And just, yeah, I pray, God, that you would use that for your glory. I lay it at your feet. So I guess I just want to land by saying, like, what's the next step for you in this journey?